In fact, if the schools weren't using Title I money any better now than they did in the first 5 years of the program, I'd like to see it abolished. But the schools have learned a great deal in compensatory education, and I think are doing a substantially improved job, and you can prove the increased achievement of many young people in many, many schools. So I'll get into that a little bit later. In education circles now, there seems to be a great concern about revenue sharing in education. Now, that's a misnomer when you call it revenue sharing in education. The administration now calls the education bill the Better Schools Act, and I think that's a misnomer too. But it isn't revenue sharing. It's more consolidation of programs. It really isn't block grants either. It's consolidation of programs into five areas. And I think to that extent it's a pretty good idea that you provide federal money for handicapped children, compensatory education for those who are disadvantaged, vocational education, impact aid money where there's a heavy federal impact, and then support services in those five. I think that's pretty good. But if any of you are concerned about the administration bill passing, you might as well forget about it now. It doesn't have a chance of passing at all. And while they haven't said so in public, the administration is off their own bill, too, because I've had a chance to talk to the president and explain to him why it isn't a very good bill. To give you an example, when I talked to him, Hugh Scott, who is the minority leader in the Senate from Pennsylvania, was sitting beside him. I told him under the formula of the administration's bill, New York would get $430 per student counted, and Pennsylvania would get $230 per student counted. And you could see Hugh Scott's eyes light up at that thought. And then realizing the president had some close connection with California, I mentioned that California would only get $220 per counted student instead of $430 like New York. And that was pretty much enough to shoot it down there, too. But another mistake of it is that they propose that you can take 30% of the money away from handicapped children and put it someplace else, or 30% away from vocational education and put it someplace else. And both of these areas, I think, have had to struggle for money for their programs, and they got a good, healthy lobby in Washington, too, so there isn't a chance of that ever passing. As I look at elementary and secondary education, I think the federal government should assist, and to a larger extent than it has now. But I do not believe that the federal government ought to provide for general aid education, because I think there are three areas that we ought to help that are not adequately supported at the present time. Those three areas are special education for the handicapped, compensatory education for the educationally disadvantaged, and vocational education, or probably better to say, the teaching of occupational skills for those who won't go beyond high school. It's my feeling that a school superintendent should feel as much responsibility that a student leaving high school not going on post-secondary education secure a job as he now feels for those who are qualified to go on to college, gets into college. And you can ask most school superintendents and ask them, in the fall, how many of your graduating class last spring are going to college? He can give you a pretty good, accurate figure on that. Ask him how many have a job, and he hasn't got the slightest idea how many have a job. I think that's a mistake. I think it's important to the federal government because in those three areas, we'll assume heavy financial responsibilities afterwards if a good job isn't done, you know, either in welfare or in manpower retraining, trying to give people skills. So I think those are the three areas we ought to move in.
Now, can I ask a question? What are your definitions of educationally disadvantaged?
Well, that's interesting that the Congress didn't know what an educationally disadvantaged child was, so it never put a definition in the bill. And most schools at the time it was passed didn't know what an educationally disadvantaged child was. But my feeling is that an educationally disadvantaged child is anyone who cannot keep up with the average level of education. So it could be because of physical or mental handicap, or it could be because of their cultural or social background that caused them to be disadvantaged and it's just as debilitating. If you come from a social, cultural background, that does not enable you to achieve as well. That's the way I
think. Doesn't that have to be defined in the bill if you expect the state to use the money properly after they get it?
Well, let me come to that a little bit later, Marian, because that's the part I think that we have to do. To give you an idea of the use of Title I money at first, a number of schools didn't know what to do with it, and an equipment salesman would come by and say, "What are you using your Title I money for?" And they said, "We haven't figured that out yet." And he said, "I happen to have the forms here and the equipment, and I'll help you fill them out." And he had figured out how the readers would accept the proposals that were sent in. A number of schools bought so much equipment, I imagine they've untraded it now, but many of them didn't even untrade all the equipment that they purchased. Or to give you an example of Kentucky, even 3 years ago, 15,000 kids were getting remedial math, 94,000 kids were getting physical education with Title I money. And I asked them if they couldn't just let them run around the schoolhouse for free until they got their exercise and help them with their reading and math. But I know Kentucky changed from that. But in those three areas, now, our dilemma at the present time is that, as I mentioned, the administration's formula isn't very good for equitable distribution of the money. But the present formula in the Act is even worse, because this last year we used 1960 census information to distribute the money based on the number of children from families with incomes of $2,000 or less, plus AFDC. Now, this coming year, we're going to use this new census information, but we're going to hold every state harmless, meaning they won't get any less money. It means they won't get any less money than they did under the 60 census. Here's what's happened between 1960 and 1970. I'll just pick a couple of states, the biggest change. North Carolina had a 70% reduction in the number of children from families of $2,000 or less. Iowa had a 68% reduction. Nevada had a 23% increase. That's kind of a small state. But California, the largest state, had a 3% increase of children who come from families of $2,000 or less. See, if you use that factor, the income factor, you know, the thing is all skewed out of shape because of the shifts in population and increase in industrial activity in some of the states in the South. Use that. Now, AFDC was used to make the program more current. And when we first started using AFDC, it was a small factor. Now, more children this coming year will be counted under the AFDC, Aid for Families of Dependent Children, than the $2,000 income under the census. And I feel this is inaccurate, too, because there are some people who are more prone to go on welfare than others. And there's one group of people in this country that are educationally disadvantaged, and that's the Mexican Americans. But for some reason or other, they have too much pride to go on welfare to a large extent as compared to whites and blacks. And so the Mexican American is not being counted where he lives. And you can look in Los Angeles with schools that have 90% white, 90% black, and 90% Mexican Americans, and see that that isn't accurate. Or in Minnesota, and the other states as well, Minnesota, where you use township relief, and the rural counties are much tougher on letting a family go on AFDC than the two counties, Hennepin and Ramsey, where Minneapolis and St. Paul exist. So Minneapolis will have double the number of children counted this coming year, and some of the rural ones will be dropped down as low as 1/25th, as much as they did before. So that whole thing is all out of shape. But I don't believe that income is an accurate way of determining whether a person is educationally disadvantaged and needs compensatory education or not. Now, it's true that there is a higher percentage of poor people who are educationally disadvantaged, but There have only been two studies that I've been able to find, and both indicate that there are more children from families with incomes above $6,500 who are educationally disadvantaged than are from families below that income. And nobody's suggesting we go to that high an income to be counted for this formula. And so what I have proposed is that we start moving towards assessment of educational achievement in order to distribute the money. Now that brings about some pretty bad reactions amongst some area or some people. One of them is that when you talk to teachers about this, the idea of testing kids is not very acceptable, because I think mostly the old standardized tests. Now it's interesting that Michigan has passed a law which distributes their money for disadvantaged children based on educational achievement. And the school superintendents and the principals and the teachers are accepting it more and more as they go along. But they're using criterion reference tests instead of standardized tests. And John Porter, who is the Commissioner of Education of Michigan, and a black man, tremendous individual, was the one who really sold it to the legislature. And he explains the difference between the old standardized test and criterion reference test, and the by using the analogy of a track meet or a race in a 100-yard dash. He said the standardized test operates where if he ran his 100-yard dash this way, he'd stand there on the starting boxes and fire the gun, and 10 people would be running a 100-yard dash, and have somebody on the other end checking to see who came in first, second, third, and so forth, number 10. And then he'd go over there and say to the person who came in first, "These are great race, you know," pat him on the back, the one who came in second, "Well, you ran real good, too." And he came to the one who came in 10th and said, "Well, now, what in the world's wrong with you?" And so in this case, the guy asked him, "Well, what was I supposed to do?" "Oh, that's right. Never told you what you're supposed to do. What I wanted you to do is to run the 100-yard dash in 10 seconds flat." So he brings them all back and starts them over again. This time he put a person on each one with a stopwatch. And he fires the gun again, and they all come through the same way. The same person comes in first. And he did it 9-1. His name happened to be Jesse Owens. And he checked the other ones, and the one who came in last made it in exactly 10 seconds flat. So in that case, they all achieved. But he said, in education, we've been always comparing everybody with Jesse Owens. Instead, we ought to set the goals of what the person ought to try and achieve, and then they can judge them against whether they achieve that goal or not. And to me, one of the exciting things is what's happening in many of the schools around the country, where they're starting to use criterion reference tests as a teaching tool and judging kids against that that goal. For instance, in the Rosemont school system, I visited the middle school in Apple Valley, and here the goals are set for each period, and the student can progress as fast as he or she wants to, and they go through the testing program, and when they pass their test, then they can move on to the other, but they know what they're going to achieve, and they don't feel a failure because they weren't able to keep up with the Jesse Owens. But they know how close they came to reaching that goal. So everybody achieved something, and you could set the goals of where you think the achievement ought to be. And so I think we can use that mechanism. So as we amended the bill, and this is the first that there's been any action so far, just the last week before the recess, and it isn't possible to sell the concept of dividing the money based on assessment. We don't know enough about it as yet. What we're going to do if this bill passes is the first year let the school determine whether they want to distribute the money based on educational achievement or on income. And I think the school districts will opt to divide the money based on educational achievement, because what teacher really knows what the income of the children, the parents of the children are. Minnesota, they use the system where the teachers look at the students and make a judgment of what their parents' income would be. In West Virginia, they send a slip of paper home and ask the parents to put their income down on it. Both, I think, are bad. But, you know, teachers get a feel for who is achieving or not. They don't all do a good job, but they get a feel, and then with the help of criterion reference tests, they can do a pretty good job. The second year of the program, then we're going to permit the states to have the option of either distributing the money based on assessment or on income. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. And then in the meantime, set up a national commission to study the mechanisms of achievement tests in order to find a way of distributing the money. Another criticism comes from that.
Exactly. What do you mean by distributing the money by?
Well, there, for instance, if the Congress would appropriate $2 billion, and then you have to figure out some way of passing around to the various states. And the way it is now, each state receives the amount of money based on the number of children with $2,000 income families or less and those who are on EFDC. And this would be done based on a sampling of educational achievement in the state so they could use that money for improving the achievement.
Is that backfiring because they wanted to report this to them and get more money?
Yes, that's what a number of people raised, that they would do a poor job in order to get more money. Which indicates that, I mean, the person who's in charge of doing a poor job so they can get more money because he's the one who has to raise the money is the school superintendent. You have to assume dishonest school superintendents first. Now, assuming that they are dishonest, they can't do that by themselves. They have to go to their principals who are in charge of the school. And they have to go to the teachers who work with the children. And the teachers have to convince the children to do poorly on the test. And the students would have to get the okay from their parents, really, that they do that poorly. Now, I think it'd be a difficult task to bring off, but I grant that there would be some effort at fudging. Now, Michigan's effort to prevent fudging is that if you don't achieve the goals you set, then you don't get the money. Now, I look at that as a little harsh, at least at the beginning of the program. But that's one of the dangers that exists, is that you have a whole series of dishonest people up and down the line in order to get more money. I don't believe that it would be as bad as we might conceive, but even if there was some fudging, I don't think it would be anywhere near as bad as where it is right now, where there really is no good relationship between the poverty, I think, and the distribution of the money. And so, hopefully from the studies, now, at the present time, there is a program going on, National Assessment on Educational Achievement. And this assessment is being done like the Gallup poll is. And when a pollster goes out to find out how he's going to vote in the next election, you know, he just can't let anybody go out and ask the questions. He has to have trained pollsters in order to do it. And so the National Assessment Program has trained individuals to test students who go out into the schools to prevent, this what you were talking about, the fudging on the part of the teachers, so they would do either good or bad. If they, and from these studies, we can find out if this can be done well or not for distribution amongst the states. Now, within the program, once the money becomes available for the school, I've been really impressed by the changes that have occurred, and especially in the last 2 years in educational achievement. And as I've listened to testimony and visited schools and talked to teachers and principals and people in state departments of education, I'm trying to figure out why is it that the schools are doing so much better now than they did in the first 5 years of the program. And I see two red threads running through it. One is that a capable, well-qualified teacher, experienced teacher, can do a much better job than a teacher who is new, hasn't had the experience. In fact, the assistant superintendent of schools in Oakland, California said, give me two experienced, capable teachers to one fresh out of college. And this is kind of contrary to what we were believing for a long time, which I call the Peace Corps syndrome. And that is, if you take young, bright-eyed kids and put them in charge, and then they won't make all the mistakes of those experienced people who got all befuddled with the training from their experience in the school. And this occurred in special education for the handicapped, where the loving persons accomplished a great deal for the mentally retarded child as compared to leaving them to their own devices. But a well-qualified special education teacher for the mentally retarded, who not only was a loving individual, but had learned the skills of reaching the mentally retarded child, just had amazing results. Now, I believe the same thing is true, and as it's been proving out, is that teacher who's trained on reaching the culturally and socially disadvantaged child is doing a significant job. The other red thread that runs through it is that for there is real significant achievement, there's parental involvement. The parent was involved with what was expected of the child. And so what we have done now in the bill is to require that providing compensatory education, the teacher work out in conjunction with the students and the parents the goal that the child is to achieve over the period of time. And so there would be obligations, not just on the teacher, but on the parents and the child as well, for reaching that goal. And then that combination working together, I think, will really bear fruit. And the reason why we put that in the legislation is to try and strengthen the hand of those who have made those significant improvements in their education system. And that way, I believe, that is the way we can move now in helping young people to achieve those goals, being able at least to read and handle their math well. It's my belief that you should reach those basics, and I get quite a bit of flack from educators on that, that reading isn't all that important and math isn't all that important. You're looking at the whole person. But I don't know how that whole person can really develop well and educating himself unless he can read well and handle his math. It seems to me that a person, if he could read well, probably could educate himself. But it really takes a genius to become educated and not being able to read. Now, there's a few that have. There's, I know, a doctor, marrying Dr. Good, who was in Northfield for a while. You know, he never learned how to read at all. And he could memorize things that people told him, so he became a medical doctor. And I know a fellow who handled all the construction for Murphy Freight, who's totally blind. And he just sits down with people, does the blueprints, and he memorizes all that. And he can go in there and tell whether they're building that building right or not. No, so there are a few geniuses. So you can't completely ignore the fact that you can be well educated if you can't read. But I think for the other 99 and 44, 100, you have to read in order to do well. And I think that has to be one of the primary factors for school. And I think education legislation can help us to provide a better education for our young, federal education legislation can help us provide a better education for our young people. While the present time the federal government only provides for 7% of the cost of elementary and secondary education, in special education for the handicapped, the federal government only provides 1.5%. The rest of it comes from the states and local governments. The studies that have been made that I've seen indicated that 60% of the handicapped children receive no special education help at all. And there's a tremendous potential amongst handicapped children, and there's no way a human being can program another human being and find out what his worth is. There's an infinite worth in every individual. John Rinders showed that in his film there. To me, one of the most amazing things that I have ever read he also talked about it, was Dr. Yuri Bronfenbrenner of Cornell University, who told about the work that a fellow named Dr. Keel did, which would now be 39 years ago he began. And he ran out of money. Now we're starting to work with handicapped children and disadvantaged kids and all. They wanted him to go back and see what happened to the kids he worked with that time ago. And it was 30 years later that he went back to check on them. But what Dr. Steele did was to go to a institution for the mentally retarded, and where, as you know, we have in Faribault, Minnesota, a state school and hospital. And at one time, there were many more adults present there than there are now. But what Dr. Steele did was to take a woman who was mentally retarded to act as the mother, surrogate mother, for a mentally retarded child. And then he had the control group, of course, that were treated the way they normally are in an institution for the mentally retarded. When he went back and studied what had happened as the result of the love of what you would call an inferior mother to that child, he found that all of those that were in the control group were either still in the institution or dead. All of those who had been assigned a mother, in quotes, were out of the institution, were employed. Two of them had degrees. And the only ingredient you can put in there, really, was the love of a person who you might call inferior to the other child, to indicate how that one-to-one relationship is so important. I think, to me, that just astounds me of what can be done. And a while ago, when I came back from Russia to look at their education system, I wanted to see what's being done in some of the Scandinavian countries. And we're now doing much more for the trainable retarded. I visited a program for the trainable retarded in Sweden, and they told me that what they were hoping to do with the trainable retarded is to make 20% of them employable, you know, whether it's sheltered workshop or what have you, but 20% of them employable. And to their amazement, 80% of them became employable. And there was no way you could ever figure that out by testing them at all. And so I think this is the possibility that's available to us if we really give them that chance to develop to whatever their potential is, train individuals who really know how to do it. If I had my way, I'd put a person who was trained in special education, a person like John Renders, in charge of our schools. I'd make them school superintendents. Because in their very training, they really are working with the total of community. Because the person who works with a handicapped child must of necessity work with the parents. Because the parents are so hung up at first to know that they've got a child that's spastic or mentally retarded or blind or deaf, that unless you work with them, you really can't get through the child and the program the same way in education. I think we need to do that. I think we have, I don't want to suggest that we go back to the little one-room school, but I think we did sort of automatically some things in the little one-room school that's just plain good education. And one of the things was, you know, that the teacher had to live in one of the farm homes nearby because there wasn't a transportation to get there. And then everybody else in the school had the responsibility of the teacher coming to have dinner one night, and they had to take their turn. I'll tell you, you really have parent-teacher-student association at that dinner table. You know, all the things the parents brought home to their, I mean, the kids brought home to their parents were either proven or disproven as the teacher talks about it at that time. The interesting thing is, though, that as the school systems now invite the parents to come into the school, the parent is coming into a foreign environment. And when you talk about the ghettos of the city, those parents are coming in to a school, and the teachers are looked at as authority. And in some of the schools, you know, they even have to have policemen around in the schools to make sure that everything works right. Now, if the teacher goes into the home, she's in the environment of the parent, but the parent feels at home, and the teacher is scared to death. But the teacher, at least, has had an opportunity, should have an opportunity, through college and internship to learn how to do that. So I think that's the system that you should use. Another system that's being used so well now as a new discovery is the children in a grade two or three grades above helping the children in the grades below. On that one-room school with eight grades there, the teacher had to use some of the students in order to help teach the kids. I remember I was so embarrassed because I had to sit down beside a girl, and I was just like Ernie, and you know, I was scared of girls from the time I was born until I met Gretchen. Still scared. You know, that really helped in reading, to help another child read in the grade school. And that's a new discovery people are finding out. No, so a lot of things we did in the old days of necessity are being worked that way. So that's sort of the way I think we're moving on federal aid to education. I've tried to tell people where I think we ought to go, because it's best not to just theorize about it, but also talk about the money, because money's kind of an important factor, especially now when the budget and impounding funds are so important. And I let people know that if I have my way, and what I'm driving for is for the federal government to fund about 25% of the cost of elementary and secondary education in the country, rather than 7% now. Because the programs we're talking about are going to cost considerably additional amounts of money. If I have my way, and what I'm driving for is for the federal government to fund about 25% of the cost of elementary and secondary education in the country, rather than 7% now. Because the programs we're talking about are going to cost considerably additional amounts of money. But the federal government's going to be stuck with additional amounts of money in welfare and job training anyway, so we might as well spend it to stop the flow into that pool of inadequately educated people, rather than just working with the pool to try and draw it down. So I think that's the movement that we have to go into. But I find it interesting that despite what most people think, we are spending more money in this country on education than we are for defense. When you add money from all sources, from all levels of education, we're spending about $98 billion this year for education, and defense is in the budget proposal $81 billion, but it's going to be less than that when the Congress is done with it this year. And so we are spending quite a good deal. Dr. Lewis Bright, who was once head of education research in the Office of Education, is now doing research in Texas, indicated that if you take the year 1880 and project the increase in the gross national product and the increase in cost of education in the year either 2030 or 2040, we will be spending more for education than the gross national product, the way the curve has been going. So some of these things I'm talking about are going to cost more money. But out of this whole process, I think that curve is going to start turning down as we learn to do a more effective job in education. Well, let me respond to any questions now. I forgive you this long. Talk about the legislation.
Some of the funding, money will come from if a program is laid out for specific children. And I've been a public school teacher now for 15 years, and when they first began to talk to us about this last year, you feel like an avalanche has landed on it, because what that means is that if I have a child who I feel is handicapped and needs special help, this means that I have to sit down with a psychologist, with the special education teacher who will work with him part-time, with the principal and with the parent and with the teacher that we had last year to help figure out what his needs are. That involves a whole lot of testing on the part of several of us, as well as several hours of talking together. That means several of us sitting down and writing out a program for this child, which takes many hours of work. That means meeting with all of those same people several times during the year to determine the kind of progress the child is making. If I do this for 4 or 5 children in my class, and then I teach 30 other children who are supposed to be normal at the same time, you feel like you're in a pit that you can't climb out of. It's an impossible task. If this kind of thing is going to happen in the school, then it gets fun. Several other things have to happen too, like reducing the number of children that a teacher is accommodating for, or reducing the hours of a workload, and this kind of thing.
This means it'll take more money, and that makes the difficulty. The money becomes the difficulty, and especially with federal funds, since you don't know whether you're going to receive the money when the school begins. But it's been my feeling you could probably do a better job of planning and doing this if you knew the amount of money you were going to receive and could hire people and plan accordingly. Now people are holding contracts. They don't know whether that contract is going to be fulfilled or not. And the use also teacher aides and whether they'll actually be hired or not. But it will do. You see, we used to just turn these kids out of school, and they went to the other education system in life and began with unskilled jobs, and that isn't available to them now. So we have to do something that's different than we ever did before in America. But Germany and Japan are doing it, and I figure we can do it too. They aren't producing illiterate kids.
In terms of the allocation, would that only be on income, or would it still be on the number of disadvantaged children within the state as well?
Well, we'll have to base it on income for 2-3 more years and distributing it to the state, because the Congress wouldn't buy, nor do we have the information available to do that distribution immediately based on assessment.
For instance, how many physically disadvantaged children they have, or special education children?
Oh, no, I thought you were talking about compensatory education for disadvantaged. No, for handicapped children, the little amount of federal money that comes is distributed based on the number that exists in the state.
Okay.
On, yes, and the determination is made.
In our school district, we receive cards each year in the fall where we're supposed to sign whether or not the breadwinner of the family works for a branch of the government. And I understand they each receive a certain amount of aid. Why is this?
Well, the concept that began in 1950 was that if a new air base, for instance, came into the community, it would take land off the tax rolls, and therefore the local school could not be taxing that property to fund their kids. Also, there's a great influx of children into the school system, and it's felt that they ought to receive some assistance. And so 50% of, if the parents live off the base but work on the base, then it was assumed that about 50% of the money for running the schools comes from the property tax from homes, and therefore they would pay that. The other 50% comes from industry, and so the federal government pays the 50% for the industry part of it, or the government part of it. So that's the reason why it came about. But that's, in many areas, a big boondoggle, too. For instance, I live out in Montgomery County and work in the capital, so the capital has takes no taxable property away from Montgomery County outside of the District of Columbia, yet Montgomery County receiving 50% of the cost of educating our children. That doesn't make sense to me that we do that. Besides that, Montgomery County has the highest per capita income of any county in the United States, so they can well afford to educate their own children. They're getting about $8 million from the federal government from that source. Also, it's got the highest percentage of people with doctor's degrees, so you'd think that the parents were motivated for good education, too. So I don't think we ought to be funding that type of a program at all. There are some, and especially Category A students, and that's where the parents live on and work on the federal establishment, and therefore they pay no taxes, and they buy their stuff through the PX, so they aren't getting any sales tax off and everything. I think to that extent, the federal government ought to be paying for the education of those children. But it's hard to change that, because about 318 or 19 members of Congress have substantial federal aid impacted school districts going to their congressional in their congressional district, and therefore they don't want to change that law at all because they feel they might lose some money, and so that's kind of a hopeless thing. I try to change it, even though we get some in the first district to regularly get along without the money.
You said that well-being of teachers are important to the children.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering why you don't have any money in your title program to provide money to employ or give additional education background to have better qualified teachers.
Well, if my amendments carry us way through, there will be this time. And this is based on my experience in Minnesota when I was in the legislature. When I was there, I carried the bills for making education for the educably handicapped mandatory. And prior to that, there was money for the handicapped that just went to the school, and the money wasn't well expended. And Dr. Maynard Reynolds, University of Minnesota, really gave us this concept that spend your money in training better qualified teachers, and you'll get a great deal more for your money. And at first people looked at that, you know, that's giving money to the university instead of the school. And but we were able to sell it to the legislature. And I think it really has done an excellent job in Minnesota, and that's why we kind of stand out again in the program for handicapped children in Minnesota, because of that. Incidentally, we learned it from the state of Washington.
In my school district, we have reduced our federal program, or we want some program because the administration was so bad that it was not in line with our goals and our objectives. We didn't want them because these people are going to be banned and giving money and we're doing it.
Senator, now that, thank God, the bombings have ended in Southeast Asia, do you see a change of priorities of our money for more educational programs rather than highways and things of this nature? We see a reversal of the priorities when that is these money that were used for bombings for highways or educational programs?
Well, it's, that's going to be hard to tell because the Congress has not expressed itself on priorities yet. In fact, the Congress is at present incapable of doing this. Now that's kind of shocking to you probably, to think that your legislative body is incapable. But in 1921, the Congress established the Bureau of the Budget in the office of the President. And that meant they gave over to the President the decisions on priorities, various areas of expenditures. The Congress could do something about it, but never had the courage to do it well. And the reason why I say that is I can explain it this way. Under President Johnson, the Congress put a limit on the amount that the President could spend. And then they went ahead and appropriated more money than they told him he could spend. And then they wrote some laws where that he could not reduce the expenditures to stay within the budget, so he had to reduce others to a greater extent. Now, nobody said anything about that. It wasn't a constitutional crisis because the same political party controlled both the Congress and the administration. Incidentally, President Johnson impounded more money than President Nixon has done each year. Under President Nixon, the President has set the limit on his spending. For instance, last year, the President had a budget of $248 billion, and he said he didn't want to spend any more than $250 billion. And the Congress appropriated, so when we went home in October, $261 billion, or $11 billion over that which he said he wanted to spend. And so he impounded $8.7 billion, and then there was a constitutional crisis developed. Out of this, you see, the Congress really didn't set its priorities. But there is some hope for the future, and that is, and when the last debt ceiling was increased at the end of last year, a committee was set up, which is now called the Ullman Committee, in which the Congress would appoint from its members a group on a committee that would look at the total budget presented by the President, do its own independent studies of the adequacy in each of the areas of expenditures, the amount of revenue we expect we could raise from it, the kind of deficit that we would find acceptable that year, and then if anybody wanted to change it from that, it'd take a two-thirds vote to change it. So then in the beginning of the year, the Congress could look at the total budget and say, we don't want to spend as much on highways, we don't want to spend as much on defense, we want to spend more on education, more on health than is in the budget. And so we would, if this is passed, have the capability of doing it, and I don't see any way of doing it without that kind of a change. Now there's a struggle going on in the Congress because the question there comes of who's going to be on that committee. Some people figure if it's rigged so they're more conservative members of the Congress, they won't like it, they'll vote against it. So we haven't got the bill passed as yet. As far as education is concerned, I'm waiting to see if that can be enacted. If it's not enacted, then I'm going to propose that we operate federal assistance to education like we do with the trust fund for highways and for airports. And that is, take a certain tax and earmark it for that purpose, put it into a trust fund. Then everybody in education will know the amount of money that's available there and can plan accordingly. Then, because in both those two programs, the money is available a year ahead of time. And except for the empowerment of funds that the president does in the highway program, they know a year ahead of time the amount of money that's going to be available. But I should warn you that you can't expect that the $81 billion for defense is now going to be shifted over someplace else. I would expect that the Congress might cut the defense budget down $4 or $5 billion. We don't know at all because those budget, those appropriation bills aren't out at all, but I think that's about the amount that the Congress will cut, because 60% of the increase in the defense budget comes from increase in pay in order to make all voluntary military come from. So nobody's going to suggest that we cut the pay for the guys in the service. But the question will come on the other part of it, on whether we now move to some other weapon systems that were deferred because of the Vietnam War. And that's tied up, of course, with the negotiations with the Warsaw Pact on mutual troop reductions in Europe, and is tied up with the continued SALT talks for weapons control. And so that means it isn't going to happen right away. But my hope is that we'll move in the direction of setting higher priorities to some of the human programs. But it isn't that we have not done that, because I think you ought to be aware of, under this president, who is not the most appealing individual I've noticed around here to many people, when he took office, we spent 45 cents out of every federal dollar for defense and 32 cents out of every federal dollar for human resource programs. Remember that? 45 cents out of every federal dollar for defense, 32 cents out of every federal dollar for human resource programs. The budget he proposed for next year, not what the Congress has forced on him, but what he's proposed, puts 47 cents out of every federal dollar for human resource programs and 30 cents of every federal dollar for defense. So there has been a change in priority. I know it isn't sufficient to what I'd like to see done, and I know to many of you, but I still want to throw that out so that you know that we aren't understanding still what we once were 4 years ago. Yeah.
You spoke about the money that we've spent for defense and the money that we've spent for education and missing education and seeing more. Does that include the state and local?
Yes. State, local, private, from preschool through post-secondary education. It's not the federal government. No. We're way under it there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Education
from all sources. You see, there's only one level of government that handles defense, and that's the federal government. Nobody else will do it. If you neglect your defense there, nobody's going to pick it up. But on health, welfare, education, and so forth, it's shared. You know, started out with private people being concerned with their fellow man, and then they went to their local governments, and so they spent a great deal.
One of the reasons that it's a concern, I believe, is because local taxes could hardly go up very much more to cover education costs that are rising.
Mm-hmm.
And as I see it, the only way we can possibly do the job in education is to get more federal funding.
Well, there's no money available to the federal government that's not also available to the state, with the exception of import duty. And so the states can do it. And it's interesting that the states, by and large, have a substantial surplus of money available to them now compared to the federal government's deficit. So you can do it. I look at the federal government as, say, for instance, in education, achieving certain purposes that it's the national interest to do it. That's why I put those three areas that I think is definitely the national interest to work on. I also look at the federal government as providing an equalizer between states, just as the Serrano decision and the Rodriguez decision attempted, and probably will in California, but it's since the Supreme Court to reverse the Rodriguez decision at once in Texas, because that was a federal court. But that was attempting to equalize the expenditures within the state. Now, a number of states are moving in that direction. Anyway, for instance, in Minnesota, 70% of the money now comes from the state for education to do with equalizers. But it has some problems with it as well. It isn't all good. And that is, it may end up with mediocrity, too. Because if everybody's equal and you prevent any schools from being the lighthouse schools, I mean, going above anybody else, we may then, a decade or 20 years from now, find that we are not making the achievements as we were when some could go on beyond what was, you know, normal for the whole state.
Well, it's kind of a matter of an individual being aware of what priorities might be and getting more money.
See, what I'd like to see is the state, coupled with the federal money, establish what is a good education and fund that, but let the communities go beyond that to the extent for the extra ones. If we don't, and then I would think that we might move in the direction of Russia's pioneer palaces, where you take all these extras, you know, the camera club and the dance and the puppet theater and music and so forth, and pay that separately yourself outside of the regular school system in order to get it done. Because if there is an inadequate job on some of these, what might look like frills to some people, you know, there are individuals that are going to want their children to have that kind of an education. And they may find ways outside the school system to do it. That's too far ahead of us to really conjecture where we're going on that. Yeah?
Probably the most difficult under your criteria is of, you know, qualified teachers and parent involvement is the one on parent involvement. Where if you're talking about compensatory education, those parents who, you know, educating those children up to preschool level are really not doing the kind of job that other parents are doing, and therefore to expect them to do the kind of homework with their children as we would want, you know, they really can't handle. Our experience teaches us that they're not ready to do this because they themselves have experienced a disadvantage. In fact, in Anoka County, we had, would you believe, 42% had not finished high school at all. That's a very high percentage. This was in his best program. So, and the fact that you say parents are at a disadvantage when they come to school for conferences, this is very true. And I think probably one of the advantages of the whole district in another program having success is because she's the guest in the parent, and she has to take her cues from where the parent is at and to keep it creative. I wonder what schools are actually planning for in the area of parent involvement, if it's the same bag. And if it's so, we find parents making kids learn. Well, that's not the way to do it, and it turns children off. They do not expect their parents to see their failures, and that whole thing is there. Instead of a parent being a parent and letting it be that, they become also the teacher, seeing how much the children are failing, and gets them in a conflict, which is rather subtle, but it's important.
It's interesting to watch the schools that have started moving in this. They realize they can't start in high school, and then they start in the elementary school, and finally they start in kindergarten because that's as low as they go. And they start asking us, why can't we use this money for preschool programs? They say, well, you can. The law's written, so you can. And they say, oh, is that right? And they start looking at. And I mentioned to Pat the other day that Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who really impresses me in the studies that he's made, when we asked him how soon you ought to start with a child, he said 2 years before the child was born. So how important do you think the parents really are?
So maybe the program of Home Start could be a program under, I don't know if it's under schools or what it could be, but
it could be under schools. I don't know how you feel about that, but I like to see the preschool programs connected with schools. I know it's like tough to get some of the people in the schools to look at preschool as their responsibility. But The reason why you're trying to do a good job in preschool is to enable them to assimilate when they get to school. And so the two need to be tied together. It was just like when some of the new math, for instance, came into the high schools when they didn't work this in conjunction with the colleges. You know, kids came to college out of high school, and that first year algebra was something in college was something that just they've been through all of that, and they should have worked the two together. In fact, the whole education system has to be a continuum, and rather than cutting it up in chunks.
Well, Al, if you want to go back to this before the children are born, I've always wondered when all these new, what's called family arts education programs are put into the junior high and high school. Why not a back at parent education? They talk about parenting up to the point of birth, and then they quit. And from my experience, that part was really a snap. You know, it was after I brought the kid home from the hospital, and all I did it. And I really started from training.
Nobody really knew, probably.
I think there are enough infant stimulation programs around to give some help to parents in the very, in the children's very early years. Up for 3 years.
Well, there's a lot of that developed now.
Right.
So,
are there any safeguards in education funding from the federal government to ensure that the less affluent school districts will get as big a piece of the pie as the more aggressive, better funded
So there are some things you can do. One is to get away from matching grants. Title III of the National Defense Education Act, which is the equipment title, started out with equipment for math, science, and modern foreign languages. Now, for everything is on a matching grant basis. We've done a good job of providing equipment for the schools that are fluent enough to match. The ones who really need help are the ones that never could match because they don't have the money. So one is to remove that. The other problem is when you have a categorical program operating for a while in order to stimulate interest in a certain endeavor, is to eventually then move away from project grants and move that into a formula grant. Because a project grant is one where a person has to develop a project that a reader will then be excited about and grant the money for. And I liken it to writing essay examinations in college. If you can capture some of the phrases the professor used, he's more likely to give you an A than if you just use your own words. And so the people who really know how to write project grants are the ones who know how to capture the attention of readers. And then they approve the grant, and I don't think that's entirely fair. Also, I don't like the idea of the federal government then handing off the grant. I'd like to shift it to where the state distributes those project grants, because I've done this myself, where there's a grant that really looks exceptionally good, and going to the Office of Education and say, hey, you shouldn't have turned that one down, take a look at it. Again, and they take another look at it and approve it. Now, I try not to abuse that, but it would be possible to substantially abuse it for my congressional district, because I am the ranking Republican on the Education and Labor Committee, and the administration is in my political party, and I could really turn the screws on them to fund all kinds of proposals in my congressional district. Now, that means that if a person elects an individual who is a new congressman that doesn't have that seniority, or elect somebody from the other political party so he doesn't have any clout at all down there in the administration because he's new from the other party, you know, they aren't going to get those kinds of funds. And I think that's wrong. And so that's another amendment that the committee adopted, is that we shift many of these individual programs now into one support service or one innovative program and be administered by the state instead. So you can take your chances within the state and at that chunk of money that comes to your state. Because it's amazing to watch how some of the money goes in the country. You know, it's no surprise that all those military bases are down in the South. It isn't because just the weather is better down there. It's because those Southern senators and congressmen stayed in office longer, and they just got all that money down into their either congressional district or state. And I think that's wrong to do it that way. So that's what I'd say is ways of getting away from it.
I wonder if any of the other parts of the country are seeing the same kind of thing that we are in. Our community is a fairly affluent suburb, and we are finding a decrease in closing schools rather than building new schools. And this may take care of, hopefully, if UCG is an actuality, maybe we'll be getting into some of the, taking care of some of the problems before they exist and doing funding, just funding the state thing.
Well, you know, if you look at the demographic chart and see what's happening to birth, you know, it isn't just the hospitals they're closing. Some of the maternity wards, some of the early years in school, now the classrooms are standing empty.
You mentioned early in your talk that Minnesota had 2.8% functional illiterates and South Carolina 52%, something like
that. Yeah, that was back in 65.
Yeah, no. Was there, do you have any figures on a per capita expenditure for students? For the two states?
Minnesota is much higher than North Carolina. Minnesota is above the national average, substantially, in expenditures for education. Interesting, California is rich, isn't it? It's just a little below the national average in expenditures for education. So that's kind of astounding. And the Serrano decision, remember, it ran from $2,500 per child in one school district to $450 in another school district, so it started a disparity between districts in California, too.